everybody to the Art Gallery Walsall. It's very glad to see you all here on such a glorious day. Do we really want to be inside? But it's so
right,
we've got air conditioning in here. That's one way of getting people in an art gallery. Anyway, welcome everybody. I'm really glad you've come to this talk. I'd like to introduce Ellen Morgan, who's the curator of the exhibition, who's going to talk to you about REMA.
As Jo just said, I'm Ellen Morgan. I'm actually also doing a PhD about Epstein and 20th century sculpture. So any questions that you have, kind of fire them out. And there'll be time at the end for questions, but also it's fairly informal. So you do feel free to interrupt me as I go along if you want me to explain anything a bit better. My aim today is to kind of introduce the exhibition and explain the rationale behind it, and then also talk about Epstein's REMA, the design process, and the extreme controversy that the final work caused. And so the rationale was to display a selection of Epstein's preparatory drawings for his W.H. Hudson Memorial, which is this photograph here. And just to be clear, it's also referred to as Epstein's REMA. The whole thing is the memorial. Epstein carved the central panel there, and it depicts REMA. So it's called the Hudson Memorial and Epstein's REMA. And the idea behind the exhibition was it provides a rare opportunity to explore Jacob Epstein's creative imagination in the context of the collections here at the New Art Gallery in Walsall. The sculpture itself is in Hyde Park in London, and the sketches were originally part of a sketchbook. It was a 56-page sketchbook, and in total there are 86 drawings, so this is a kind of broad selection of them. And the drawings have come from Leeds, where they're kept in the archive at the Henry Moore Institute. And the drawings document Epstein's design process whilst he was coming up with the ideas for this sculpture, which actually is not something you often get to see in exhibitions. There's this kind of slightly misleading assumption that can be traced back to the Renaissance, and particularly to Michelangelo, that fine art, painting and sculpture, is kind of created by these artist geniuses without very much preparation. And it's kind of seen perhaps as kind of taking the edge off their genius if you actually show the process they went through. But for me, as an art historian, it actually just adds extra levels to it. As I said, it kind of goes back to Michelangelo, this idea of the artist genius who spontaneously creates them, because he went to a lot of effort to destroy lots of his preparatory drawings and his models for sculptures in order to keep this idea. And then, obviously, Epstein is a 20th century sculptor, but at the turn of the 20th century, the date of this work is 1925, so from 1900 up until the 1930s, there's a kind of resurgence of interest in Michelangelo and his sculptural technique. And Epstein was also a very vocal fan of Michelangelo's work. And the resurgence of interest in Michelangelo resulted in a sculptural technique associated with the early 20th century called direct carving. And this sculpture was directly carved. And that means they just didn't make any models beforehand. Normally, a sculptor, they're given a commission for a large-scale work, and they start by making a miniature clay version of what they want to make. And then usually they make a full-size plaster version, which is often transferred to the stone via a method called pointing. And that involves a wooden frame is set up around the plaster block, and you take measurements from the frame to kind of sticky out bits of the sculpture, like the nose and the position of the arms and the knees. You then take the wooden frame off the plaster, put it around the block, and you transfer the measurements by drilling into the block as far as like the end of the nose would be. But obviously with direct carving, they didn't do any of that. But that doesn't mean that no preparation was involved. Because if you think about it, the huge cost of sculptural materials and the kind of risk involved in not following a model, because if you kind of slip with the chisel, it's kind of rare that you can fix that. You can't really stick bits of stone back on again. And so what sculptors did was they produced a lot of drawings and they spent a long time kind of carefully preparing. And Epstein actually worked on the commission for REMA for 18 months before he actually started carving. But then when the carving process did start, he did literally go straight to the block and carve it by hand. And now, as I said, the idea for the exhibition was to explore his creative imagination in the context of the New Art Gallery of Warsaw, and particularly the Garman-Ryan collection, which for me as an Epstein scholar, and in terms of this exhibition, is a wonderful resource. Particularly with regards to this exhibition, Epstein amassed throughout his career a huge collection of what are referred to as primitive artworks and artifacts. And these are kind of objects, we put a couple in the display cabinet, but these are objects that kind of from all over the world, particularly the kind of non-Western world. And not only to Epstein's art was it very important, but it actually played a really important role in the development of 20th century painting, both sculpture and painting as well. And the kind of big role that it played was it actually kind of elicited the movement away from kind of more traditional figurative sculpture, much more towards freer, kind of more abstract sculpture. And with Epstein, it's interesting to note, people refer to Epstein as kind of being two Epsteins because he's got these two strains. He's got his much more traditional bronzes, which you can see kind of all over the gallery, his portraits, but he also did large-scale bronzes as well. But then he's got his carvings as well, which are much more kind of modern-looking, and that's where the influence of the primitive art comes in. And just to give you a bit of context about kind of primitive art, from the late 19th century up until the 1930s, it's been referred to the age of great excavations, and it's actually the time when archaeology is established as a discipline. And so all over the world, you've got these artifacts being dug up out of the ground, archaic and ancient art. And obviously a lot of the works that they're digging up are sculptures and bits of sculptures. And so for 20th century sculptors, this was very exciting. It was kind of new, fresh material to work with. And as I said, Epstein collected, amassed a huge collection of them. That was a very important collection. When he died, most of it went to the British Museum, which attests to its importance. But some of the objects in this collection here at Warsaw are believed to have been part of his original collection. And as well as the objects themselves, in the archive that we've got loads of photographs of his primitive collection. We just included a couple in the exhibition, but obviously limitations of space mean there's only a few. And the photographs show individual works. He had lots of kind of masks and carvings, bits of pottery and different artifacts. But also they show it displayed in his house. And I can't exaggerate it enough that his house was full to bursting with these objects kind of everywhere. I think Henry Moore said that he didn't know where Epstein slept because you couldn't really see any furniture because everything was covered in these artifacts. And what struck me when I went up to Leeds to see these drawings immediately was I think they show Epstein drawing the things around him, drawing these objects. And I've got a couple of printouts here. They're not kind of the best quality, but just to kind of give you an idea. This is a North American carving of a figure riding a bear. And it's kind of the crouched position of the rider and the kind of geometric lines and shapes. I'm just going to move over here because if I kind of point to this drawing over here, we've got Rima in the same position and with the angular lines. Another one of Epstein's objects was this little soapstone figure from Sierra Leone. And this one, I think we hold it up next to this one. Not only the position of Rima's legs, the seated kind of crouching position, but the elongated head as well. And so, yeah, he's got these objects in front of them and he's drawing them and they're kind of sparking his ideas. Downstairs in the gallery, we've got this mask that was believed to be Queen Nefertiti. And again, if we hold it up to this sculpture, to this drawing, you can see the influence, the kind of simplistic, kind of stylized beauty. And there was also the drawings of the birds there. Mrs. Epstein, Epstein's first wife, apparently went out and brought studio props for Epstein, and one of them was a stuffed eagle. And in the other drawings still up in Leeds, there's quite a few drawings of birds where he's drawing this eagle that's in his studio. But as well as just move to the middle, as well as collecting these artefacts, he's also being influenced by the work of other artists, in particular his artist friends. And again, downstairs, we've got this drawing by Modigliani, which is of a caryatid. You can see it downstairs. And Epstein, before doing Rima, he was working in Paris on his tomb for Oscar Wilde. And he became really good friends with Modigliani. And Modigliani apparently gave Epstein this sketch, which Epstein displayed in his living room his entire life and was kind of really fond of the drawing. But again, we can see traces of this drawing in the Rima designs, particularly kind of that one, the mask-like female faces, and also kind of masks there as well. So not only his masks from his primitive collection, but also his influence of his friend Modigliani. And also, Epstein's work for the tomb for Oscar Wilde again crops up in some of these drawings. This is part of the Garman Ryan collection as well, and this is Epstein's sketch for his tomb for Oscar Wilde. And it's the drawing straight in front of me there. It's the kind of angular lines and the kind of Egyptian or Assyrian influences in it. And so, again, Epstein's own work is influencing these as well. And as I, sorry, it is Père Lachaise Cemetery, yeah. It is, they've recently,
when you can get through the crowds.
Like, yeah, they've recently restored it as well, because it was Oscar Wilde's tomb. People were kissing it and leaving lipstick marks all over it, and they've cleaned all those off and put glass round it. But apparently everyone's now kissing the glass instead of the sculpture.
Père Lachaise.
But as well as Epstein's own work, as I mentioned, he's a big fan of Michelangelo. And even that crops up in these drawings. If I just hold up this picture, it's from the Sistine ceiling. It's God dividing the waters and the earth. And it's behind, it's this drawing here, the position of her hands. This is cut off because it's not the best printout. But the positioning of her, but also his kind of God's mantle is being evoked by those shadows there. And as well as that Michelangelo work, he also did a painting of Leda and the Swan. This is in the National Gallery. This is a copy after Michelangelo because his painting was lost. And not only is it a woman in a seated position, kind of with a bird, but it kind of, again, relates to that figure that I showed with the Sierra Leone figure. Now, this is from Rome mythology, and it's a story where Zeus disguises himself as a swan in order to seduce Leda. And obviously, we're not having kind of any ideas of copulation with these birds, but the motif of a woman in a seated position with birds, I think, is kind of coming through there. Another sketch from Epstein's career, his kind of famous rock drill. This drawing's downstairs as well, his study for the rock drill. And he made this drawing whilst he was briefly associated with the Vorticists. And they're a group of artists. They're kind of like the British equivalent of the Italian Futurists. They're all about glorifying the machine age and speed and geometric shapes. And here it's these drawings that you see that coming through, the angular lines, the simplified geometric shapes, but also the evocation of speed. The British Vorticists disbanded at the outbreak of the First World War because instead of glorifying machinery, they were suddenly realised the kind of destruction that it could cause, and Epstein turned his back on it. But his kind of Vorticist inspiration is still cropping up again to do with Rima. There's even, it was noted at the time and subsequently, that there seems to be a model that Epstein was using for the sculpture in itself. This is from the Ludovisi throne, which is in the National Museum of Rome. And it was a fragment that was dug up during the excavations. And again, it's the position of the woman and her arms. But also interestingly, as I said, this is a fragment from a throne. So it's not a full figure, she's cut off. But also, if we look, so is Rima. And people did notice at the time that it looked like an ancient fragment. So the idea, like I said, was to look at his design process for a large-scale work in the context of the Garman Ryan collection, and we see the influence of his primitive art collection, of his friends, artists, and also Michelangelo, and also just his other work that he's doing around a similar time. So I'm now going to talk a bit more about the commission for the sculpture itself and the kind of extreme controversy that the finished work caused, which I find kind of fascinating because to look at it through 21st century eyes, it just seems so harmless and innocuous. But it's not, I'm not exaggerating to say it's unprecedented the amount of criticism that Epstein got for this work. For those of you who don't know, of course, William Henry Hudson was a novelist, but he was also a bird watcher, and he helped found the RSPB. And so the idea for the commission was to kind of commemorate Hudson and his writing and his work. But the sculpture itself is also a bird sanctuary in Hyde Park. You can't see it in this photograph, but there's a bath of like water for birds to bathe in, lots of grass and foliage and green all around it. And when Hudson died in 1922, a memorial committee was set up to oversee the commission, and Epstein was approached and asked to submit a design. Now, this is perhaps a little bit surprising. At the time, Epstein was a very popular portraitist, but his previous large-scale public commissions, his Strand statues in London in 1908 and his tomb for Oscar Wilde in 1912, both created a storm of controversy. And this is perhaps why a committee was set up to oversee it. I don't think they were ever going to give Epstein totally kind of free rein to do it. The sculpture itself is what we refer to as a relief carving. Instead of being a kind of three-dimensional freestanding sculpture, it's carved into a flat panel. And relief carving has been used since antiquity, and it's kind of thought of as carving pictures into stone. And if you look around the room, you'll notice on some of the drawings he's added kind of blue and pink and green washes to them. And this was because he knew he was doing a relief carving, the washes helped him work out kind of how the projecting bits of the stone would look against the dark background. So he's kind of thinking about the shadows created by the relief carving, and that's what a lot of the washes are for. I'll just say a bit about Green Mansions as well to give you a bit of background. It was Hudson's most popular book. It was published in 1904, and it's an exotic tale of romance, but it's also a kind of comment about man's ignorant destruction of the natural world. And it features Abel, who's the story's narrator, and he meets this mysterious, beautiful, half-wild forest nymph who lives in the jungles in South America, and they meet and fall in love, and together they travel across the jungles to Rima's homeland, where she meets her tragic fate. She's chased by natives who fear her kind of mysterious, slightly kind of mystical powers, and she's chased up into a tree and it's burned and she dies. And these drawings here perhaps are Epstein thinking about the end passage of the book where she's being chased up into this tree. And so when Epstein was approached, his first idea for a sculpture was actually going to be a portrait of Hudson, but His Majesty's Office of Works said that they didn't want portraits in public parks at the time, and so they decided to say that he had to do Rima. But again, as I said, he still wasn't given free rein. He had to submit the designs for consideration. First, he had to submit them to the committee, but then when they liked them, they then had to submit them to the Office of Works, and then they had to submit them to the king with an explanation of the meaning because, and I quote, considerable hostile criticism was anticipated. And again, this is because Epstein was seen as a rebel. Epstein's second design, after his portrait idea was dismissed, he did a much more kind of narrative scene of Rima in amongst trees and birds and kind of with lots of background. And that design was rejected by Office of Works, and I quote, for fear that it would evoke wide and even bitter controversy. And so Epstein had to go away again. He reread Green Mansions and came up with a third design that was finally approved in July 1924. And during the time when he's submitting these designs, his sketchbook's also being circulated amongst the committee as well. And what's interesting about the sketchbook, I thought, when you see all the drawings together, they're not systematically arranged. There's no way of knowing which order he drew them in. And some of the drawings are kind of drawn on top of other ones and on the side and on the back. And I think this was Epstein's excitement in being given a commission that interested him, because he got to kind of explore ideas about human nature and about kind of wild sides of human nature. Another thing to notice, actually, quite an obvious point when you look around the room, is none of the drawings, and also none of the ones in Leeds, actually look very much like the final sculpture. The one over there is kind of the closest. And this had a lot to do with the fact that it was the Office of Works that decided what panel Epstein would be given to carve. And when it came to carving, once they'd approved his design, the panel that he was given was like loads smaller than he was anticipating. And Bernard Shaw actually is quoted as ridiculing the size of the panel as being the size of a postage stamp. And because it was a lot smaller, obviously he had to modify his design. And this is also partly why it's kind of fragmented and cut off, because he just didn't have the room. All he could fit on it was Rima and these birds. There's no background details or anything. All that had to go. But interestingly, it's been noted that because there's no background details and because she's been pushed up against the frame, her head is kind of literally right at the top of the panel, it kind of creates this diagonal sense of movement, which was kind of described as an uprush of wild and free spirit, which, as I said, seems to be very in keeping with the character of Rima. The location of the memorial was also very appropriate. Like I said, it's a Berg sanctuary. It's surrounded by trees. And the novel Green Mansions, the title refers to giant trees in the Venezuelan jungle. And so on the face of it, it all seems very appropriate. But as I said, it was startlingly criticised, and part of the criticism against it was people accused Epstein of not having even read the book, and the kind of their ideas about nature and kind of beauty were very different to what they were kind of found themselves faced with. But if I just read you a chapter, a little extract from Green Mansions, where Hudson describes the jungle, and if we look at this image, I just think it evokes it wonderfully. It says, "Even where the trees were largest, the sunlight penetrated, subdued by the foliage to exquisite greenish-golden tints, filling the whole lower spaces with tender half-lights and faint blue and grey shadows." And this photograph was taken on a beautiful summer's day. And you got that. You got this sense of shimmering light and changing colours. The total cost of the finished sculpture was £1,875, 18 shillings and 3 pence. And out of that, Epstein was given £500. Now, what's interesting is the entire funds were raised by public donations, which on the face of it seems wonderfully positive. The public are willing to pay for sculptures. But as I talk about the controversy, rather than it being a triumph, it was deemed an outright failure by most people concerned. So I'll now kind of talk about the controversy, which, like I said, I just find just mind-blowing, really. The sculpture was unveiled by the Prime Minister, Mr. Stanley Baldwin, on the 19th of May 1925. We've got a picture of the unveiling in the cabinet there. And apparently there was a huge crowd gathered, and Mr. Baldwin started off by praising Hudson for awakening the public to the beauties of nature and the natural world, and he then drew back the curtain. Now, Epstein said he would never forget the look on the Prime Minister's face and the gasp of horror that was emitted by the crowd. And so why were they so shocked? They were expecting Hudson's Rima, the physical and spiritual embodiment of beauty, and what it looked like they were being given was this kind of allegedly crudely carved, unnaturalistic figure of an apparently distorted nude girl surrounded by monstrous birds. And immediately after the unveiling, the press launched an absolutely brutal campaign of vilification, not only against the sculpture, but against Epstein himself as well. And I'm not exaggerating to say that between May 1925 and December 1925, there are literally hundreds of letters and articles, cartoons, caricatures, limericks, just every day in the national and local papers, just kind of absolutely berating this sculpture. And reports became rife that a large percentage of the public were extremely offended by the sculpture, and reports were so rife that Parliament was actually aware of the unrest. But rather than being reflected of any kind of spontaneous public idea, it's actually fair to say that the attacks were kind of carefully orchestrated by the media, in particular the kind of right-wing papers such as the Morning Post, who referred to the sculpture as Mr. Epstein's nightmare in stone. They also referred to the hideous masterpiece as perhaps the most famous example of a great sculptor who has sold his soul to the devil. And also the Daily Mail actively campaigned to have what they referred to as the Hyde Park atrocity removed. And when their campaign to have it removed failed, they continued to propose things like covering it with ivy or a slab of concrete. And now, above all, what they were upset about was this idea of how you represent beauty. At the time, the art world is very much dominated by art institutions and the academies, and they're kind of all still dominated by Greek and Roman ideals of beauty, which is all about order, symmetry, proportion. Whereas this is incredibly modern looking at the time. It's incredibly, it's very much related to primitive art, and it's directly carved. And these were all things that at the time people were saying produces ugly sculpture. It's basically at the time, this was the contemporary art that everyone hated, kind of a bit like Tracy Emin and kind of Damien Hirst. Now it's kind of very fashionable to kind of have a bit of a go at them as well. And if I just show you these pictures of public sculptures that were done around a similar time. We've got here, it's Sir Alfred Gilbert Anteros, which is actually referred to as Eros, which is in Piccadilly Circus in London. And then we've got George Frampton's Peter Pan, which is in Kensington Gardens, and it's not very far away from Rima. And if you look at these again, they're very Greek and Roman kind of ideals. They're naturalistic figures. They're kind of flowing lines and traditional beauty, whereas that was kind of a bit too stark and modern looking for them. And people kind of kept quoting Hudson, who referred to Rima. He said that Rima, who surpassed in loveliness all human faces, whereas the newspapers were pointing out that this was a crude and malformed goddess, or a poulterer's wife being conducted to hell by two frozen turkeys, which is a particular favourite quote of mine. But interestingly, if you kind of get your teeth into Green Mansions and you read Hudson, he wasn't talking about this kind of natural traditional beauty. And through the narrator, Abel, Hudson actually makes the point that he says that although the forest nymph appeared beautiful to him, the reader may not share his delight because strangeness is rarely accepted as beautiful. Unfamiliarity frightens people. And this was an idea that Epstein certainly bought into. In his autobiography, he said that nature does not appear to the artist as she does to the ordinary non-creative man. And he says as well, in all beauty, there's an element of strangeness and unfamiliarity, which ordinary non-creative people find alarming. And so whilst the public are kind of absolutely shocked and appalled by it, I think Hudson and Epstein actually shared an idea about a kind of wild beauty rather than a traditional beauty. And so the fact that the kind of that it's very modern looking, the fact that that upset people perhaps isn't so surprising. But what is surprising and rather disheartening is the fact that the campaign against Rima took a kind of much more sinister turn because the papers started criticising it on political and racial grounds. And if we think about it, the 1920s, this was unveiled in 1925, was a very kind of politically turbulent time. And maximising the fact that kind of the aims of socialism and fascism and Bolshevism were not clearly understood, and that ism in modernism could also be easily confused, the media started to scapegoat Rima as an expression in stone of the spirit of anarchy. And the unnatural appearance of the female figure was soon accounted for by the fact that Jacob Epstein was Jewish. And as I said, Parliament was campaigning to have it removed. On the 30th of November 1925, the Speaker of the House of Commons announced, "I think this lady has taken up enough of our time." But this wasn't actually the end of the matter. Between 1925 and 1935, Rima was vandalised on four occasions. And some of these are quite shocking. The first one, November 1925, law students were caught doing it. They covered it in green paint and wrote "O. Epstein" all over it. In October 1925, Rima was tarred and feathered. In January 1930, she was painted red, green and black. But in October 1935, members of the Independent Fascist League actually attacked the sculpture with an alkaline solution that was very abrasive and kind of did a lot of damage to it. But they also covered it in swastikas and the slogan, "God save our king and Britain from the cancer of Judah," which, like I said, I find just incredibly shocking. Unfortunately, Epstein was a foreign artist with a very kind of Germanic sounding name, and he was also Jewish. And at the time, like I said, it's a very turbulent time, and ideas of national identity and nationalism are kind of very fraught. And so, wrong time, wrong place, wrong sculptor, I think. And the furore that the memorial caused is actually still unprecedented in the art world today. Like I said, if you think about controversial figures like Damien Hirst and Tracy Emin, and people kind of write kind of disparaging things about them, and when there was the fire at the Saatchi Gallery, people kind of said, "Hooray, all this terrible art has gone." But no one's ever actually tried to destroy like their work, like in situ in a park. Now, amongst the derision and mockery of Rima, there were a few people that stood up for Rima. There were. They were kind of far outweighed by the people that were against it. The art critic for the Times wrote, and I thought this was very fitting, he said, "I cannot help thinking that all those who were repelled by Mr. Epstein's panel conceive of nature as an opportunity for picnics." And I think that's very fitting. There's also the kind of very influential art critic and patron of the arts at the time, Roger Fry, who did stand up for Epstein, but I think only rather reluctantly. He was reported to say, "I'm not going to pretend that the Hudson Memorial has converted me to an enthusiastic admirer of Mr. Epstein's sculpture, or that it causes me any profound emotional reaction, but it does have certain qualities that are almost always absent from our public sculpture." And so even those that did stand up for Epstein, they're still a bit reluctant to do so. Epstein was very much a scapegoat and kind of seen as the epitome of the modernist artist, and exactly what people kind of wanted to have a go at the time. But we can kind of put a bit more of a positive spin on the controversy. At the very least, it got everyone talking about sculpture. Epstein kind of slightly arrogantly said that the controversy surrounding his work throughout his career, he said that he made London sculpture conscious. Because instead of kind of indifference to public sculptures, everyone was kind of stating an opinion, however negative that was. There's one newspaper, The Builder, that wrote, "At least the public is beginning to interest itself in artistic values. 20 years ago, anything might have been erected in Hyde Park, however fine or however monstrous, without anyone outside the world of art taking the slightest interest in it or expressing an opinion one way or the other. Now we can read in our morning papers a daily cascade of pro-Epstein and anti-Epstein sentiments, and this in itself is a wonderful portent because it looks like the beginnings of public criticism." Now, unfortunately, I think it's fair to say that was a little bit over-optimistic, because Epstein's name continued to excite uneasiness and alarm, and those opposed to modernism and avant-garde art persisted in their denigration of it. And it's not until relatively recently that this kind of was acknowledged as a very important masterpiece, even, of direct carving. But it's also fair to point out that it's in Hyde Park, but it's tucked away. Nobody really knows where it is, and there's absolutely nothing anywhere near it to tell you that Epstein did it. And so even though people are recognising it, it's still a little bit like a kind of dirty little secret of what happened in modern sculpture. Now, Epstein himself was undoubtedly deeply troubled by the bitterness that his work caused, but he did remain true to his vision and unrepentant, and he continued to create carvings as well as his bronzes. He did kind of go on to make lots of other carvings that were very controversial. But just to end, I like that he was reported to go and visit Rima from time to time, wondering what all the fuss was about. So that's kind of whistle-stop tour of the exhibition and the sculpture itself and the controversy. If anyone's got any questions they'd like to ask, please do feel free.
I think it was what you say, very good. Is that you explained to us the controversy and also the lampooning of the first, with all aspects of expression or can't be used to criticise or otherwise, I think.
Very, very much so. Like the media is kind of very deliberate in their choice of words to throw in words like anarchy. It's kind of deliberately orchestrated to scapegoat Epstein as this kind of foreigner. What's he doing in our country, making these things in our beautiful kind of British parks? Right, definitely.
The person who was very, very politically minded, with the politicians at the present moment, not in the class of a politician in the 1920s and 30s, the way that they used to lampoon their people.
Yeah. it was a very, like I said, a very turbulent time. You've just finished the First World War. Kind of another world war was kind of starting to loom. It was a very turbulent time, and Epstein was the perfect scapegoat. Because actually, I find interesting, part of Epstein's legacy is the fact that he was scapegoated in all this controversy. Henry Moore, who kind of superseded Epstein, was obviously British born. He was from Leeds. But also he said that because Epstein took the brickbats and the howls of derision, the younger generation, like himself, was spared. Because Epstein had showed the art world this, he'd broken down a few taboos. So when Moore and Hepworth started creating more abstract sculpture, it was a little bit more acceptable.
When were the statues around the British Medical Building? How long after that?
They were his first commission. They were 1908. Mainly one sculpture, Maternity, of a nude, naked woman, not nude. They said it's a very different, that a nude is this artistic style, whereas naked is a woman without her clothes on. And there was one called Maternity that members of the National Vigilance Society took offence to, and they kind of campaigned to have them removed. And the battle went on. They were erected in 1908, and the battle went on to 1935, I think, when, just kind of coincidentally, one of the sculptures, apparently a bit of it broke off and fell to the ground. And so everyone that was against them suddenly went, they're dangerous, they're going to injure someone, get rid of them. And so they hacked off any bits that might fall off.
Yeah. And that was in 1935?
That was when they were defaced, yeah.
Because, upstairs, if you want to see it, anybody, on the fourth floor, there's a lot of photos, aren't there, by Bob and Roberta Smith, of those statues that were defaced.
Are they still up there? Yeah.
But people asked if they could take a cast of them, didn't they, before they were destroyed, and the brothers said no.
They did actually take some casts. It was Epstein that said, can he take some casts? And they said, no, Epstein, you can't, we'll do it. But they apparently didn't get kind of trained plasterers to do it, and Epstein was very upset with the quality of the plasters that were taken. But he actually kept one of the plasters in his studio. There's a photograph of his studio from the end of his life, the 1950s, that shows that he kept one of these plaster fragments in his studio.
Yeah,
Was the work done actually in situ there, or was it done somewhere else and then transported?
It was finished off in situ. He started off, they had to build him a purpose-built studio because it was too big to fit in his own. And so he kind of roughed it out in his studio, and then the final details were kind of polished in situ. Yeah, and they apparently had to erect a kind of covering over it to stop people looking at it.
The crowd, otherwise people would have had a wind of what was already to come.
Yeah.
It sounds like they were totally surprised.
Yeah, definitely. And it was very secretive. Because Epstein's previous works had created such controversy, kind of they very much tried to keep it under wraps and very secretive.
Was this house
Yes, Hyde Park Corner, yeah.
Yeah.
That's where he lived, his second wife, Kathleen Garman.
Yeah. And all his books are downstairs in the basement.
In the archive, yeah. They've also got lots of kind of his letters and personal documents
all,
as well.
All his books are downstairs in the basement, but that's amazing.
Yeah. Well, that's why this gallery is such a wonderful resource, because it's the only one. It's not only talking about Epstein the artist, it's Epstein the man, like, as well. You've got all of this here. That's why it's wonderful to do an exhibition of his kind of, it's his artistic imagination, really, isn't it? So.
And this is something which people, I'm from Canada, I was talking to this gentleman earlier on, but our constituency, we had the first Minister for the Arts, Jane Lee. If I want to come to have any inverted commas culture now, I don't get the entire, because there isn't any. I have to come to places like
this. Yeah, well, it was Epstein's second wife, Kathleen, was from the Black Country. I think she was from Wensbury, and that's why she kind of donated the collection to the Borough of Warsaw. She didn't want it to all go to London.
You know how that happened? She was in a coffee house with a friend up here, and she couldn't get anybody to take it. And apparently there was a councillor from Warsaw sitting at the next table, and he overheard this conversation, and he introduced himself to him. He said, look, The library, you know, in the main street, he said, you know, like, that's empty, you know, so we could take most of this stuff. And she said, okay, you can have it, you know. So
oh, right, I wasn't aware of that.
Enough, but, you know, that's apparently how
also
got on with this stuff.
Yeah. Brilliant. Yeah. Well, yeah, it is, because, like, a lot of his work, kind of, his primitive collection, as I said, went to the British Museum, but other objects from his studio, apparently Kathleen, there's an article in the archive that she wanted to preserve his studio as a kind of museum space for students, but plans for that fell through, but a lot of his plasters went to Israel, and a lot of his work kind of is dotted about, but this kind of collection here is kind of arguably kind of one of the most comprehensive to span his whole career.
So why are these sketches coming from Leeds then?
That's the Leeds archive has also got an enormous Epstein archive. It's got some of the things, duplicates, photos that are here. But obviously Leeds is a centre for study of sculpture. It's a centre of excellence for sculpture because of Henry Moore. He was from Leeds. And so when that was set up, a lot of things were donated to Leeds as well because it was going to be a centre for study.
And you pointed out that there were a few people who supported Rima.
Yeah, a few.
But didn't the established art world support it?
Not really, like I said, only very reluctantly. And again, because it was Epstein, when other people started doing it, like Henry Moore, they were very supportive. But
in the pre-Raphaelite still.
Yeah, well, they are. They're very dominated by 19th century traditional art.
I think as well, but another reason why there was a reluctance to accept it, because I think you did, if I accepted it, and there's a lot of pretty stuff, the people who accepted might classify themselves having a leg on their face.
I suppose so, yeah. There was, it was also the Evening Standard quote there was actually from the Royal Academy's then president, that he said that if people saw it and copied it, then the world would be made hideous. But obviously the Royal Academy is one of the very traditional art academies. So
there was also a lot of jealousy and competition from the more traditional Royal Academy artists. because these commissions are few and far between as they still are now. So, you know, to be able to get that commission to produce a piece of public sculpture was quite important. So the jealousy that Epstein had right from the start when he was given the Strand Statues Commission just continued and resulted in him being unable to become a war artist in the First World War.
Yep.
So he was commissioned into the Jewish Fusiliers. There are all sorts of sort of spin-offs and results of that sort of that attitude that was around at the time.
Yeah.
Competition and jealousy.
You see, another thing as well, because I find some people say to me, are you interested in art? I said, yeah, so I'm interested in some of it. But I said, I can appreciate what other people have done, because of the expertise and the thought and the inspiration that, they, that that artist must have had. Both in painting, sculpting, and also in the written words, which I think we all forget.
Yeah.
That the description in language is in my view, but equally as important as a description on the canvas.
Yep, and it's interesting to say that because Epstein very famously, other than when he was directly kind of addressing specific criticisms, he kind of famously kept insisting that I rest silent in my sculpture. He was saying he didn't think words were adequate to describe art and that art objects should speak for themselves. He was kind of very, very kind of full of that, definitely.
One of the main lessons to learn from Epstein is that he was a contemporary artist of his time, and that you should look at contemporary art of today with a similarly open mind, and not go, oh, it's hideous, I hate it.
Could you say something? You're giving a talk on Epstein's mistress, aren't you, next month?
I don't think so.
Oh.
Not that I'm aware of it.
Oh, the...
I don't think it was Epstein.
Oh, sorry.
Yes. No, I'm not doing that. Carol Jacobi will be coming to give the talk on it.
That's in June.
Yeah.
Some ballet dancers are going to perform here on that.
Yeah, probably say it.
So if anybody's interested, you know, that should be.
Get some invites.
But I think it's also to say, just going back to the fact that these drawings are in Leeds, actually, I think it's interesting that they're in the archive at Leeds. They're not in the gallery. They're not actually on display. And that goes back to this idea about artworks speaking for themselves and not kind of talking about the process for art themselves, because otherwise these would be on display in Leeds rather than filed away in an archive.
Some of the sketches over this site, anywhere 1923,
yep.
It's erected in 1925.
Yep.
How long does it actually take it when you start the process in the special studio?
The actual carving. The carving was done in, I think it was a couple of months, it was unveiled in May. He was accepted in January. In fact, he started in February and then it was unveiled in May. So the actual carving was loads less than the 18 months that he spent planning it and submitting designs.
Do come to the opening of Isabel Rawsthorne exhibition. She's a fascinating artist, and when I first started researching her, I did so because of her being the mother of his fifth child, not realising what an extraordinary artist she was in her own right. But in actual fact, she is, and this is the first exhibition of her dance related drawings and paintings. Really, that has been held. There were a couple of small ones in the 80s, 1980s, but the work has all been sort of hidden away for a very, very long time, so it's great to be able to host it. It's going on to the Royal Opera House in February next year.
When did she pass away?
1996, I think,
something like that.
Yes.
You know, it must be very, very difficult, though, for her. Relatives, famous people, to be able to pursue a similar thing and be given the credit in their own right as to their expertise in painting and sculpture and things like that.
Well, yes, absolutely. Yeah.
And particularly for women artists as well, yeah. And women were traditionally the muses and the models.
One of his daughters was Laurie Lee's wife or mistress, I can't remember which.
Oh, I don't know.
Yeah, another one was quite a famous ballerina. Mm. And I can't remember, there was another one. Freud, I think Lucian Freud.
Oh, his daughter, Kitty, was married to Lucian Freud.
Yeah, that's right, sorry, yeah. So three of his, did make their own mark on 20th century history, if you like. You know.
The connection with Laurie Lee is Kathleen's sister, Lorna, had an illegitimate child with Laurie Lee.
Then
Laurie Lee went on to marry Kathleen and Lorna's niece, Kathleen. There's a wonderful book called Dean Dreams by Cresta Connolly that we have for sale in the shop. That tells you a lot about the family, in particular about Kathleen and her brothers and sisters, who are quite extraordinary. Her brother, Douglas, had a long love affair with Peggy Guggenheim, the Guggenheim collection, New York. So just as a family, they're quite extraordinary. Yeah. The girls at the garden side, and they came from Wensbury just up the road.
Yes, yeah. Well, it was a father, wasn't it? A doctor, wasn't it?
Yes, doctor.
Her father was a doctor in Wensbury. And this is like in
19th century, yes.
Because the reason she met, so in the book anyway, she went to this, she wanted to go to art school because in those days, girls couldn't do much, you know, apart from be a nurse or go to art college.
And even when they went to art college, it was often just to be taught embroidery.
Yeah. And she went to this cafe in Paddington because she heard lots of artists working there, and apparently Epstein saw her and sent a note over saying, "I'm a sculptor, I think you're very beautiful. Would you model for me?"
Yep.
And apparently so the story goes, again, I don't know whether it's profitable, but she ran out. But she went back the following night.
Yeah.
But you know, it's even worse in Scotland. Even in the 1950s. I have a friend by the name of Julie. She, because she was the girl, she was not allowed to go to university, but her two brothers were.
Yes.
You know, about in the late 50s.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is there anything still happening around the world to women today?
Yes.
We may have changed a bit in this country, but there are many other countries in which it haven't.
Yeah, thank you everyone for coming. Thank you.